Friday, August 22nd from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Lois King Education Center. These artists will focus on bog diversity and the importance of peatlands. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $160,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Learn more about Alzheimer's disease at a presentation with Dr. Joseph Gogler from the University of Minnesota on Wednesday, August 20th. Gogler will be at the Clearbrook Senior Center at 9 a.m. and the Bemidji Senior Center at 1 p.m. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Israel says it is calling up an additional 50,000 reservists for a major military operation against Hamas in Gaza City. The call-up letters are expected to be sent out soon, with the draft starting in the coming month. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Tel Aviv.
The decision to call up additional reservists came after Israeli military leaders gave preliminary approval to the next phase of the war in Gaza. The increase will almost double the number of active reservists in the nearly two-year-old war. An Israeli military official, speaking on condition of anonymity, says many of the reservists will free up active-duty troops currently deployed in other areas so they can fight in the densely populated Gaza City, in areas heavily controlled by Hamas. Israeli troops are already laying the groundwork for a broader upcoming operation. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
NATO defense leaders are scheduled to hold a virtual meeting today. They're expected to discuss what security guarantees could be offered to Ukraine to help end Russia's war there. Defense officials from the UK and other countries are also meeting at the Pentagon today to discuss the war. The governors of six states are sending their own National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. They're to assist in President Trump's initiative to tackle crime. But as NPR's Meg Anderson reports, several of those states have crime problems of their own.
The governors in West Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, Ohio, and Tennessee have all pledged to send their own National Guard troops to D.C. for the Trump administration's crime campaign. But violent crime in the district is falling, and last year, cities in at least four of those states had higher murder rates than Washington's. In Mississippi, for instance, Jackson's murder rate was nearly four times the rate in D.C., and in Memphis, Tennessee, the murder rate was nearly triple. Incha Rahman of the Vera Institute of Justice says that signals to her,
this is about a political power grab and political theater, not about making cities safer.
NPR reached out to the governors in Mississippi and Tennessee, but did not receive a response. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen has announced plans to transition a state corrections facility into an immigration detention center. From Nebraska Public Media, Arthur Jones has more.
The facility, called the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services Work Ethic Camp, can currently house 200 people. Nebraska's Director of Correctional Services, Rob Jeffries, says NDCS will continue to handle local operations, but the work will be federally funded.
The partnership will be formalized with an interstate support agency with an initial 365-day commitment. With re-up, with a commitment of at least 3 years in negotiations.
There is currently no timeline for when it will begin to house individuals. For NPR News, I'm Arthur Jones in Lincoln, Nebraska.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The White House has launched an account on the popular video sharing app TikTok. The new account features a video of President Trump. He is heard declaring, quote, "I am your voice." Stargazers are in for a rare lunar event this weekend. NPR's Chandelise Duster previews the phenomenon known as the black moon.
When the visible side of the moon is not illuminated by the sun, we can't see the moon in the sky. That is called the new moon phase of the lunar cycle. Saturday's new moon is called a black moon because it is the third of four new moons to occur this season. And because our side of the moon will be in darkness this weekend, the black moon will be invisible. But planetary scientist Ashley Walker says the occurrence is still important.
This is not an astronomical term. However, I definitely think that this is something that folks could share their love and their passion for astronomy.
The next Black Moon is not set to take place until August 2027. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
Hurricane Erin is sweeping through the Atlantic Ocean between the East Coast and Bermuda. Top sustained winds are at 100 miles per hour. Erin is not expected to hit land, but it's kicking up rip currents from Florida to New England beaches. Officials are warning people to stay out of the ocean. Several states are under heat cautions today. Extreme heat warnings are posted in western Mississippi as well as in the desert southwest. It could hit 120 degrees today in Death Valley, California. These temperatures will spread through parts of Arizona and Nevada. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
I do think there's a fine balance between oversharing and not sharing enough the struggles.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Major General Retired Joanna Clyborn, and I served in the Minnesota National Guard and in the military for the last 35 years. To a certain extent, I blame social media. Right? You see the successes, you see the great stories, but what you don't see behind the scenes is no one's posting about the 3 a.m. wake-ups or the tears or the frustrations or the failures, because we choose not to allow people to see that. It doesn't mean it's not there. But if you have occasional days where you're not happy, where things aren't going right, where you feel like you just don't measure up, that is normal. If all you ever portray is that you're happy and that everything is awesome and you never let anyone behind that facade, then that's part of the challenge.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Following meetings with President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House, European leaders have been urgently trying to figure out what they need to do next to end Russia's nearly four-year war in Ukraine. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll speak with Trump's former National Security Advisor John Bolton about what a security guarantee would actually look like.
But one thing the president ruled out is sending U.S. troops.
From Brussels, Terry Schultz joins us now to talk about the challenges Europe faces with so many factors still dependent on Washington. So, Terry, how have European leaders been digesting the events from D.C.?
Well, quickly is the best way I can describe it. It was less than 24 hours after those meetings at the White House that the EU leaders who'd been present there were back here in virtual sessions debriefing their counterparts. And that urgency just goes to show how high stakes the situation is for Europe. They had both a meeting of this coalition of the willing, that's some 30 countries which have expressed their readiness to physically help support a ceasefire in Ukraine, and they had one with just the 27 EU member countries.
President Trump has made it pretty clear that he wants Europe to take the lead on Ukrainian security. That's our understanding, right?
That's right. And they'd more or less already decided that themselves before Trump became more supportive of Ukraine. But now the president has confirmed it many times over. And the good news for the Europeans is that Trump is now pledging for the first time to help with these security guarantees for Ukraine. Chairing the meeting of EU leaders, European Council President Antonio Costa said Europe is actually now working hand in hand with the U.S.
Their commitment to participate in the security guarantees with the Europeans and other like-minded countries is a very important step, a very welcome step.
Now, Costa says there's still a difficult road ahead, but Europeans are feeling reassured by the new U.S. support.
Okay, now, how might this look, though, practically? I mean, this coalition has been meeting for months without the participation of the U.S.
Well, and also without even a basic outline of what a final peace deal might look like between Russia and Ukraine. So what would be the rules and protections and obligations of such a mission on the ground? In addition, it's been hamstrung since it was created by the U.S. lack of support earlier, which is really critical both in terms of capabilities such as intelligence sharing and surveillance, where the U.S. is dominant, but also the deterrent factor, sort of the stick that you have with an agreement backed by the U.S., especially in the eyes of the Kremlin. So now discussions will take a new, more optimistic shape.
Now, President Trump says no U.S. troops would join this mission. So how willing are Europeans to send their people into Ukraine?
Well, that's a huge unanswered question, because it's not clear whether this mission would be to sort of monitor a ceasefire or reinforce it or defend certain lines. And those verbs all mean very different things, carrying different levels of danger for those deployed. In general, European countries are going to have to send forces, and it seems about 10 have committed to doing that so far. But some options are much less palatable than others. And if this is a small force that's just there to deter Russia reattacking Ukraine, this is sometimes described as a tripwire force, what happens if it is attacked? We don't have any answers yet. Or are we going to need to see hundreds of thousands of European military personnel armed to fight back? I think that's pretty unlikely.
So how does then this fit into this idea of, quote, NATO-style security guarantees that the Trump administration first brought up?
Well, another unanswered question, but I basically described the dilemma already. With NATO's Article 5, an attack on one is considered an attack on all. So if you apply this to Ukraine, will all European Union members or NATO members, including the U.S., come if it's attacked again after a peace deal? And what about if a European soldier is attacked? I think everyone here is eager to hear what kind of commitments the U.S. is ready to make. And certainly Trump's latest suggestion that air power could be provided will be welcome.
That's Terry Schultz in Brussels. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk more about what a security guarantee for Ukraine could look like. We're going to ask John Bolton this. He served as national security advisor during the first Trump administration. He was also the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President George W. Bush. Ambassador Bolton, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Well, thanks for having me.
So before we get to the specifics of what a security guarantee could look like, can I just get your top line reaction to the events of the last couple of days, the separate meetings with the two presidents and the European leaders?
Well, I think there's a lot of movement, a lot of motion, but no real substantive change. There's no indication at all that Russia has in any way changed its objective, which is to bring Ukraine into the greater Russian Empire, nor is there any real sign that Zelensky is prepared to do the sorts of things that Russia has demanded of President Trump, such as ceding a substantial part of the Donetsk Oblast or province, which the Russians have not yet been able to conquer militarily. So I think the motion has been interesting and is likely to continue because Donald Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize. But in terms of actual movement toward a settlement, I don't see it.
So, okay, in recent days, there's been a lot of talk about land concessions by Ukraine in exchange for peace. But I also want to say again that Putin's pretext for the full-scale invasion of Ukraine was the possibility of Ukraine's NATO membership. NATO membership is a security guarantee. So given that, what indication is there that any security guarantee, is there any security guarantee that President Putin would accept?
Well, there's a lot of loose talk in the West about security guarantees, and many observers have pointed out we gave Ukraine security guarantees with the Budapest Memorandum in 1994. Mm-hmm. That didn't deter Russia then. People throw around this talk of an Article 5-like provision. You know, Article 5 in the Treaty of Washington that created NATO is famous for the line that an attack on one will be deemed an attack on all. And nobody forgets the line, nobody remembers the line a little bit further down in Article 5 that says that each party will, and I'm quoting now, take such action as it deems necessary, close quote. So that could mean sending Ukraine a note saying, we're very distressed to hear that Russia's invaded you again. We wish you all the best and do let us know how it turns out. Article 5 in NATO means something because of the U.S. force behind it. Now, Donald Trump has said that there will be no boots on the ground. He has said something vague about air power, which a lot of people have taken to mean, okay, well, we'll be all right then. It'll be all right. Well, what air power does he mean? I'm not being critical. I'm just asking the question. Does he mean U.S. A-10 Warthog close air support aircraft involved protecting British and French troops on the ground? Does he mean U.S. B-52 and B-2 bombers striking strategic Russian targets to relieve pressure on the British and French troops? Does he mean fighter bombers going in after Russian positions? Does he mean he's willing to accept American combat with Russians in the air concededly, but combat with Russians to protect the European peacekeeping force? Or is he talking about C-130 transport planes? Mm. It'd be nice to get an answer there.
So are European militaries capable of providing the type of security that you've described to Ukraine, or is some measure of participation by the United States an essential element for this to be credible at all?
Well, I don't think they've thought through what they really think they're going to do. Are they talking about, it would be helpful to say, what's the mission of this force? Is it to defeat a potential Russian incursion? Is it to be peace enforcement where there would be combat? Or are they really talking and hoping and praying what they want is a UN peacekeeping force where the only use of force for the peacekeepers is in self-defense? These are two very different missions, and the requirements are obviously very different as well. This to me is all indication. There's a lot of hot air out there. That's what diplomats do frequently. Even political leaders engage in hot air. But the substance here is pretty thin on the ground.
Before we let you go, just 30 seconds left here. Do you think that this is essentially a distraction to keep the war going because Putin thinks he has the military advantage at this point?
Well, I think Putin's doing just fine at the moment. I think what we've not done for 3.5 years, frankly, is given Ukraine what it's necessary, not simply to avoid losing the war, but to win the war. And I don't see, again, any indication, whether by the United States or by the Europeans, that's about to change. And as long as the real pressure that the U.S. and Europeans could put on strict sanctions, harshly enforced, vigorously enforced, I think Putin thinks he can get away with it.
That's John Bolton. He served as the National Security Advisor during the first Trump administration. Ambassador Bolton, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks again for having me.
Wildfires are tearing across Spain, killing several people and scorching nearly 1,500 square miles. From Seville, here's NPR's Miguel Macias.
Last week, Pepe Neira was sailing off of the coast of Tarifa, near the Strait of Gibraltar in southern Spain, when he and his friends saw large columns of smoke back inland. At first, they didn't worry much, but then...
We realized this was serious. We could see the orange color of the flames in the distance.
When they got back to the coast, thousands of people were evacuating the area, a very popular vacation spot in the summer season. Neira decided to stay. The next morning,
planes were refilling with water at a reservoir nearby, but helicopters were refilling straight out of the ocean, flying over us and getting to the fire, which was less than 2 miles away.
The scene was striking, but far from the worst in recent weeks in Spain. North of Tarifa, in the region of Extremadura, firefighter Adrián Pastor was battling flames to try to save a village.
We had to get exposed so much to the smoke. I start to feel dizzy. I starting to have headaches. I started feeling so weak. I couldn't even walk.
Pastor had to be taken out of the area by his fellow firefighters. He's back to work now. But he says that the conditions this year prepared the way for disaster.
After a year of heavy rainfall that caused vegetation to grow, followed by an extremely hot July, that dried everything out. Combined with continuous heat waves in August.
In other words, the fires were primed to explode and nearly impossible to contain. In fact, two major fires in the northwest of the country have grown to become the largest on record. Across the nation, nearly 4,000 soldiers have been brought in to help battle the fires as European allies rush in firefighters and equipment to support overwhelmed emergency crews. On Tuesday, after 16 straight days of brutal heat, Spain finally saw temperatures dip, but many of the fires are still burning. Miguel Macias, NPR News, Seville, Spain.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and in just a bit, I'll be joined by Jen Kellen, and we'll be here until 9 o'clock. Then we're going to hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXE in Bemidji. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The Board's meeting schedule is available at kaxe.org. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. United Way of 1000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org. And we receive support from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com. And the Itasca County Family YMCA will be closed for plumbing work August 25th through the 27th. The outdoor courts will still be available. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Environmental Protection Agency has proposed reversing a scientific finding it made more than a decade ago that climate pollution threatens public health and welfare. That finding has been the basis for federal climate regulations. But instead of being a relief for companies, the proposed change from the EPA could create legal problems for them. NPR's Michael Copley explains.
Neighborhoods around Charleston, South Carolina are flooding more often as climate change raises sea levels and drives more intense rainstorms, threatening billions in losses. So Charleston sued oil and gas companies in state court for allegedly concealing the dangers of burning fossil fuels. The case was thrown out recently, in part because the judge said greenhouse gas pollution is an issue for the federal government to deal with. That was good news for the oil and gas industry. It's battling a wave of climate lawsuits from states and other municipalities, and it's long argued that climate pollution needs to be dealt with at the federal level. But the Trump administration now says the federal government doesn't have that authority, and that could weaken the industry's ability to defend itself. Jeff Homestead is an environmental lawyer and was an EPA official under former President George W. Bush.
There's already a lot of climate change litigation. There's plenty of people out there who want to bring lawsuits, and it seems like this would just invite a lot more litigation.
Theodore Boutros, a lawyer for the oil and gas company Chevron, told NPR that no matter what the Trump administration does, the Supreme Court's already found greenhouse gas emissions are covered by federal law. But Trump administration supporters think the court's primed to overturn that ruling. Homestead says it's a toss-up.
There's just a lot of legal uncertainty if the administration's preferred approach will actually stand up in court.
There are other risks looming for businesses if the Environmental Protection Agency reverses the endangerment finding it made more than a decade ago, when it found climate pollution threatens public health and welfare. The endangerment finding has underpinned federal climate regulations since 2009. Companies often complain those rules are too strict, but Lisa Jacobson says having the EPA regulate climate pollution has given businesses predictability to make big, long-term investments. She says that predictability is now in jeopardy. Jacobson runs the Business Council for Sustainable Energy, whose members include major electricity producers.
I look at what the administration wants to accomplish with regards to our national security and winning the AI race. We want to have expansive energy production. We have that opportunity. We can do that affordably, and we can do it while we're managing air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions.
Jacobson says she'd rather be helping companies build that infrastructure rather than debating changes to regulatory policy,
which will cause disruption in planning and moving forward with projects we need today.
The American Petroleum Institute, a trade group for the oil and gas industry, said in a statement to NPR that it continues to support federal regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. The EPA told NPR that the agency hasn't taken any final action on its proposal. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Big donors are rushing to fill the gap left when Congress cut funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The move is threatening the future of local public TV and radio stations. Now, a group of philanthropists are giving money to the Public Media Bridge Fund. They hope that fund will bridge the gap. It's being run by a nonprofit called the Public Media Company, and its CEO is Tim Izgat, and he's with me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Layla.
So, Tim, if you could just start by telling me what this fund is and what the Public Media Company is.
Sure. The Public Media Bridge Fund is a pooled philanthropic fund operated by Public Media Company that really aims to secure local public media service with a focus really on those rural and underserved areas of the country where local stations, local public media organizations are most at risk of going dark.
How many stations are at risk of their doors closing if they don't get the money they need?
Yeah, so we use some data from 2023 from CPB that suggests about 115 of the total universe of about 550 local public media organizations are at risk of going dark. Wow. These are organizations that receive 30% or more of their revenue from CPB.
Are you looking to replace the $1.1 billion that was cut, or what's the goal here?
No, unfortunately, I just don't think that's realistic. The goal here is really to secure local service and to make sure that 43 million Americans that are served by these stations that are most at risk continue to receive local public radio and television service. These communities are almost all in rural and underserved areas of the country. And, one of the great important things about public media is it's supposed to be free access to all, to every American. Right now, it covers 99% of the country, and we want to make sure that that continues.
And how much money have you been able to raise?
Well, our goal is $100 million over the next 2 years. That's roughly equivalent to what CPB would provide these at-risk stations. And we're maybe a third of the way there right now.
Can stations survive long-term by relying on big donors instead of the federal funds that they had relied on?
Well, I don't think that's a viable strategy over the long-term. So we definitely want to help stations to the extent we can move to more sustainable operating models, less dependent on that federal funding. That's going to look different in every community, but that's part of what we're trying to do here as well.
And why is this important? To the donors who are putting this money in, to you who's running Public Media Company.
You know, there are a lot of social ills right now that we could talk about. One of them is just the lack of connection that we have to each other at the community level right now. And that's why public media is structured in this country the way that it is, as a decentralized network where local communities are making local decisions about local needs. This is a public good. And it's in danger of collapsing right now. And we're going to do everything we can to prevent that from happening.
That's Tim Izgat. He's the CEO of Public Media Company, which is running the Public Media Bridge Fund. The goal of that fund is to get emergency funding to local stations that are most at risk of closing now that federal funding for public media has been cut off. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
One of Europe's largest mass graves is being unearthed in Ireland. The victims are children who died in a home for unwed mothers.
It's blatantly obvious. They had no regard for those children because they're illegitimate.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the Grave tells the story of the Catholic Church in Ireland on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear that on All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host and celebrating a birthday, Jennifer Moore. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm here with the franchise, Jen Killen.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Good. I made my way through the thick fog.
Yeah, you were mentioning it was very foggy this morning.
Yeah, and then I got downtown Bemidji, and I look like a liar, I bet, because it is...
It doesn't look foggy here.
No, it was thick out west, and thick enough that you couldn't even really drive the speed limit in a lot of places. So,
well, looking at the weather today, it's going to be patchy fog going on until 10 a.m. this morning. Otherwise, it should be a mostly sunny day, highs near 80 degrees with a calm wind. Tonight, increasing clouds, lows in the upper 50s, lower 60s. And tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and at night. Partly sunny, highs near 80, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. The days are definitely getting shorter, Jen.
They sure are. It was sure dark when I got up this morning.
Yeah, when I got out to my car, it was very dark. I could still hear like crickets going.
Now, I only do this once a month, so there's a dramatic difference. I mean, when I was here in July, it was still very light out when I woke up. But you do this every week. Mm-hmm. Do you still notice the drop-off drastically?
Like, I feel like this week is the first time I notice, like, oh, it's
dark.
Still pretty dark when I'm getting into my car kind of thing.
August is always like that, I feel like. Like, lots of light in May, June, July, and then there's something about August that it's like, oh boy, oh, it's getting dark. Oh, it's only 8 o'clock and it's getting dark.
I was playing volleyball last night and it was getting dark. By 8:30, it was pretty dark out.
Yeah, yeah. And that's always happens fast. How was volleyball? You want to talk about it, I don't know. It's playoffs.
There's playoffs.
A lot on the line here. I don't know.
Double elimination playoffs. We lost our first game in the playoffs last night. It was the first one of the night. And then we won our second game.
Okay.
So then we played the winner of another loser bracket for the third game, and we beat them too.
All right.
Barely beat them in the second game, 23 to 25.
Wow.
Last play, my buddy hit it, went right on the rope line. We won.
Wow. Dramatic finish. How did you pick yourself up after the first loss?
Well, I kind of thought we were going to lose, so I was kind of mentally prepared for that.
Okay.
But now we have to play that team again next Tuesday.
And you've seen them throughout the season,
yep.
I would imagine.
And we've never beat them throughout this season. Our record was better than theirs, but we still haven't beat them.
So they're beatable, though.
They are beatable.
That's what I hear you saying.
But they got two guys that are just really good at spiking, and it's very frustrating.
Well, should we invite those two guys to a different thing next Tuesday?
I was almost going to say it to the guy, because we both like showed up at the same time. I was like, man, I was hoping you weren't going to be here today.
I am so sorry to see you.
But I don't think we're that close. I might do it next week. Who cares? It's the last day.
Playoffs. It's do or die.
And they're not going to be in it next year. This is their last year as a team.
Okay. Well, so does that make you feel like, let them win it?
No, it makes me feel the opposite.
Okay. You want to.
Sayonara. Goodbye.
See ya.
Don't forget who sent you there.
Cutthroat.
Yeah.
So early. It's just barely 6:30.
Well, you're the one who got me all riled up about it. Support for KXE comes from the Cuyuna Crusher Mountain Bike Race, taking place Sunday, August 24th at the Cuyuna State Rec Area. Featuring over 500 racers and spectators, along with biking, food, and music in the heart of Minnesota's bike country. Proceeds support the Cuyuna Lakes Chamber and local community initiatives. More info at CuyunaLakes.com.
We also receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997. A local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com.
And we've got quite the packed show for you today.
Man, you told me yesterday.
I've warned you numerous times.
Yeah, actually you did. You started on Monday and you said, Jen, Better bring your A game.
Because we have not one, but two area voices this morning.
Wow.
One at 7:10. We're going to be talking with Denise Winkleman, a comedian who's originally from North Home, but she lives in L.A. now. She's going to talk about her new comedy special, Bougie on a Budget.
Cool.
And then at around 8:45, we're going to be talking with some members of the production of Hadestown. That's going on this weekend.
Very good. Mask and Rose.
Mask and Rose Women's Theater, yes. Yeah, and then also, we're going to be talking with a couple people about Bemidji Pride. That'll be going on this weekend, starting tomorrow night. And then also at 8:10, we're going to be talking with some people who are putting on a West African drum workshop this Friday. And it's going to be at Headwaters Music and Arts. And we're going to be talking with them around 8:10.
We have to fit this all in by 9?
By 9 o'clock, because then we're going to hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters.
Okay, let's go.
All right.
Buckle up, huh?
Yep. So we'll be back in just a bit, but now we're going to hear National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Friday, a federal judge in Phoenix seemingly cleared the way for a massive copper mining project until the Ninth Circuit suddenly stepped in. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the latest court order came less than 24 hours before Oak Flat inside the Tonto National Forest would have turned into private property.
That pending land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper has been put on hold once more, with a temporary administrative injunction issued Monday by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The new order comes after Judge Dominic Lanza denied requests to delay the congressionally authorized land transfer. These pleas came from plaintiffs, including the San Carlos Apache tribe. The tribe called it a last-minute victory, while Resolution Copper is confident the court will ultimately affirm Judge Lanza's, quote, well-reasoned orders. The three-judge panel would not comment on the merits, but noted these appeals will undergo an expedited briefing schedule starting next month. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
State lawmakers are holding a joint hearing Tuesday in Sacramento about the University of California holding Native American human remains and cultural items. Three state audits over the past 5 years show UC fails to return the remains. University officials are expected to respond. Summer is a prime time for gathering and baking camas across the Pacific Northwest, Rockies, and Plains regions. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a bake-off recently held outside Eugene, Oregon.
Sillette's tribal member Joe Scott heads the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program under the Long Tom Watershed Council. He described how he'd layer his packets of leaf-wrapped camas bulbs.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw the wet sword ferns on top of this. Bunch of water, like a couple of buckets of water after the maple leaves, and then a layer of these skunk cabbage leaves, put the packets on top of that, and then the alder and the ferns and all this stuff right here.
Oh, and there's mugwort, hazel, and bracken ferns in Scott's recipe too. The whole oven hissed with steam once the water hit the hot rocks. Nearby, the TIP senior intern and my kid, Samuel Bull of the Nez Perce tribe, assembled the second oven with mom's help. This was mostly ferns, maple leaves, and camas bundled in skunk cabbage leaves, with some carrots and potatoes thrown in for experimentation's sake, all under canvas and four buckets of water.
Yes, I would put the camas closer to the middle. Okay. Those two go. Right there is great.
Is it cooking?
Yeah.
Flash forward to a day later. Bull decided to do a camas bake for 24 hours. The group peeled back the canvas to reveal glistening and translucent camas bulbs.
Looks good.
Oh, look at those beauties.
Good?
It's really good.
Give me some flavor notes.
Really soft, sweet, and starchy.
Perfect. I'm so happy.
Wow.
And yes, Bull's potatoes and carrots came out well too. Scott's batch baked for nearly 26 hours and had a small fire burning atop his oven for part of that time. At first, there was a little concern as some bulbs were hardened and dark, but then when the rest were unearthed,
they're perfect. Wow. They're like a sweet gumdrop.
The longer bake meant Scott's camas were more caramelized and sweeter. But at the end of the day, Scott said the real success of the event was creating community. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull, near Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle, here with Jen Kellen, and coming up in just a bit, we're going to hear more from Morning Edition, talking about immigration, Florida strawberry farmers, and a Swedish church. It had to be moved because they were mining underneath it.
Oh, just like Hibbing.
Oh, that happened to Hibbing too?
Moved the whole town.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there was probably a Swedish church in there too, huh? Moved everything. Somebody will know. They could text in. Let us know.
So we were talking earlier this week about national days. And you said today was a big one.
It was. Yeah, I mean, there's not many. You know, sometimes when we do this, there are so many national days that it's like just a laundry list of things.
So I'm going to go with the ones I've got with you.
Okay.
And then
we always have a different, we always compile different lists.
So first up, we got National Accessible Air Travel Day.
Okay. Important.
Yeah. That's today. And then we also have National Chocolate Pecan Pie Day.
See, I have only had not chocolate.
Yeah, I've never heard of chocolate pecan pie. I didn't know that was an option.
That kind of makes my teeth curl thinking about it. So sweet.
Yeah.
Pecan pie by itself. Pecan, if you're from the South.
Uh-huh.
Pecan pie is so sweet. I enjoy it, but only a sliver at a time. So I can't imagine adding chocolate to it.
I would try it. Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
No question about it.
Okay.
Next up, we got National Bacon Lovers Day.
Woo-hoo.
Are you a fan of bacon?
What kind of a question? Do you like kitties and sunshine? Yes.
Lollipops.
Right. I love bacon.
What's like your go-to, just straight up eating bacon or BLT perhaps?
Yeah, it's BLT season right now.
Okay.
Big time.
What
big
do you got?
Time.
You got your bacon.
Bacon.
You got your lettuce.
Yep.
You got your tomato.
Always better from the garden, lettuce and tomato. We got some big, juicy Brandywine tomatoes right now.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Do you have a BLT on toast?
Yes.
And?
I put a little mayo on it.
Okay, well, here's my curveball in the equation.
You put pecans.
I drizzle it with chocolate. I grew up in a house where BLTs were served not with mayo, but mustard.
Mustard, eh? Okay.
So it wasn't until I got married, and I married a mayonnaise person, and now I do both.
Was that like a big point of contention with the two?
No, it was just like, you put mustard on. Okay. And so now he puts the mustard out on the counter.
Oh, so he switched for you.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he puts it on his. Oh. I think he might still just do mayo.
Oh, he's secretly doing mayo behind your back?
No. You're trying to stir stuff up. You're still all riled up from the volleyball. No, I do both mayo and mustard. It's delicious.
Together
on the same BLT. Yeah.
Do you do like mayo on one slice of bread and mustard on the other, or you put them on the same bread?
I put them on the same bread.
Okay.
They get along just fine.
That surprises me.
Does it? Are you curious to try?
I'm curious, but I'm not a huge mustard fan. I like mustard like on a hot dog.
With a name like DeZingle, you don't like a lot of mustard?
Mustard was never like a huge thing in my household.
Oh, okay. I'm a big mustard fan, I guess.
All right.
So, yes, BLTs, bacon with eggs, bacon bits, you name it.
Bacon cheeseburger, would you have that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's your favorite bacon dish?
Oh, what would be? Pizza? Bacon on pizza? Okay. I love it.
One pasta sauce that my dad made when I was growing up, you fry a little bacon, take the bacon out, and then in the bacon grease, you do a bunch of onions, and then like a tomato-based sauce, and then you crumble the bacon back in to the sauce. Delicious.
Oh, that does sound good.
It is really good. And then my grandma growing up, she always made egg noodles. She always had chickens, so she always had eggs. And that was another dish that we ate growing up. Again, fry the bacon, pull it out, and then egg noodles with crumbled bacon. You drizzle a little bit of the bacon grease and vinegar.
It was a mistake to talk about food so early in the morning show, because now I'm
We're not even getting to the most important day.
And then, yeah, well, that's what I have next. It's also National Radio Day.
Yay, here we are.
And we work in radio. We're on the radio right now.
We are? What?
So everyone listening right now, happy National Radio Day. You know what? If you want to keep public community radio going, consider making a donation today. We have recently had our federal funding rescinded.
Yep.
So we still need your help to keep us on the air. And you can do that by going to our website, kaxe.org, and clicking that donate button.
Maybe you have an old car sitting in your yard like we do.
Mm-hmm.
You could donate that.
Yeah.
You could buy tickets to Riverfest.
Yes, absolutely.
That's
going on September 6th.
That's kind of so quick.
Yeah, I can't believe it's already September and... I guess like 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Week and a half?
10 days. I know. It's coming up really fast. Let's go back to bacon.
And then also you can...
IRA,
yes.
Yes, that's a slick way to do it. If you've got IRAs, you're 70 and a half, you've got money that you need to... You can donate it to us.
So if you have been thinking like, oh, that's right, I need to donate to KXE... Now is the time. It's National Radio Day.
Yeah, what a perfect way to celebrate National Radio Day.
So we want to hear from you today, this morning. Also, we have our question of the week. Have you ever lived with roommates? Tell us about your good and not so good experience. Text 218-326-1234. We receive support from Brainstorm Bakery, headquarters of Crapola, with four flavors of granola, handcrafted at the bakery on East Sheridan Street in Ely. Online ordering available and more at brainstormbakery.com.
Support also comes from the First National Bank of Coleraine. Since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com. Member FDIC.
And we receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.com. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration wants to own a piece of the chip maker Intel. U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick confirmed this in an interview on CNBC.
For national security, we need to make our own chips here. We cannot rely on Taiwan, which is 9,500 miles away from us and only 80 miles from China.
The CHIPS and Science Act, which was signed by President Biden, aimed to keep chip making in the U.S. by giving $8 billion in direct funding to companies. Now, instead of giving money to Intel, the Trump administration wants equity. Mackenzie Hawkins covers the semiconductor industry from Bloomberg, and she joins us now from Hong Kong to tell us more about this. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this idea of the government taking equity in a private business is something most of us don't remember. I mean, my understanding, this hasn't happened since World War II. So now the government is taking something called a golden share in Nippon Steel as part of its acquisition of U.S. Steel that allows it to appoint a board member and block certain moves. So as to the chip maker Intel, what is the administration saying about why claiming a share of that company benefits the American people?
So there's a lot that we don't know about what a U.S. stake in Intel would look like. Something that Lutnick did share yesterday was that the U.S. is not seeking a governing stake. It's non-voting. What they're doing, they say, is converting CHIPS Act grants that were awarded under President Joe Biden. Intel reached a contract with the Biden administration, or under the Biden administration, for almost $8 billion in direct funding to support factories in the U.S. into equity.
Mm-hmm.
And in Lutnick's words, why are we giving a company worth $100 billion this kind of money? And what is in it for the American taxpayer? The answer Donald Trump has is we should get an equity stake for our money. The administration has been pursuing what they call a, quote, benefit of the bargain for taxpayers under the CHIPS Act since the start of the admin. And this is sort of the first concrete example of a really substantive change that we see them potentially making to one of the CHIPS Act awards.
Could Intel say no?
We haven't seen Intel comment specifically on this equity stake arrangement yet. There's been a lot of whiplash for the company over the past couple of weeks. President Donald Trump called for Intel's new CEO's ouster over concerns about past ties to China and investments in China. We saw Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan go to the White House, meet with president and cabinet members. Trump said he had an amazing story. And now we see this conversation where the administration is concerned about, you know, is Intel going to execute on these factories that they've promised, particularly in the state of Ohio? And this major U.S. company that's critical to American national security strategy in the semiconductor sector. So these are ongoing conversations. All Intel has said is they're committed to working with the administration, and they support the overall goals of revitalizing the American chipmaking industry.
So, you know, critics of the administration have said, or critics of this proposal have said, that they fear that this is a leading edge toward nationalizing private business. Has the administration responded to that kind of criticism?
So the administration says, you know, we don't want to sort of give blank checks to companies. We want, you know, we're not going to take a governing stake in Intel, although we have definitely seen Trump officials take a more sort of interventionist approach into a range of sectors, not just semiconductors, also rare earths, as you mentioned, the Nippon Steel deal. And they say this is how we're going to get the benefit of the bargain for the taxpayer. How that actually shakes out over time will be really interesting to watch. You know, there's a huge question of, is Intel going to have customers to support this massive factory expansion? You need people to actually buy the chips. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said yesterday, quote, there's no talk of trying to force companies to buy from Intel. But we've also seen Intel struggle to secure some of these orders. You know, Biden officials tried to encourage companies like NVIDIA or AMD to kind of pursue manufacturing contracts with Intel. So there's a lot to remains to be seen over whether this equity stake makes a meaningful difference for the company's long-term production ambitions.
Very quickly, does this tie into Intel's plans to try to open two semiconductor plants in Ohio, which is the home state of Vice President J.D. Vance?
It absolutely does. You know, a large share of Intel's nearly $8 billion CHIPS Act award was slated specifically to support that facility, which has been delayed several times. And we've reported that the Ohio facility is a major focus for the admin.
Mackenzie Hawkins covers the semiconductor industry for Bloomberg. Mackenzie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
All right, what would you do to find your perfect engagement ring? Well, we know what 31-year-old Michelle Fox is willing to do. She traveled from New York City to Crater of Diamonds State Park in Arkansas last month on a mission to find a diamond. Fox said she and her boyfriend thought it was important to get an ethically sourced gem for her engagement ring.
I was like, you know, they come from the ground. They come from the ground. What is conceptually stopping us from just getting one ourselves?
Fox says she started dreaming about digging up her own diamond around 2 years ago.
Then within a few days, I was like, we're not getting engaged until I do that.
Which she says her boyfriend fully supported. So when Fox had some time off after finishing grad school, she decided to rent a cabin in the woods at the state park with the only public mine in the world where people can keep the diamonds they dig up.
Fox's odds weren't great. Only 366 diamonds have been found and registered this year at a park where thousands of people visit the dig.
Nevertheless, for 3 weeks straight, she dug between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. every day with just one day a week to rest, sometimes in triple-digit heat.
There were days where I wouldn't shower for several days because it was just, by the time I got out, I was so tired and hurt. I was hurting. I couldn't muster the energy to spend 10 minutes undressing and taking a shower. Like, you know, you walk out, you walk the half a mile back to the campsite, and you're just horizontal.
At one point, she says her shovel was stolen, leaving her no choice but to walk about an hour to the closest town to find a hardware store. And then the day before she planned to leave,
I see this glimmer by my foot.
Fox thought that that was because she was in the shadows. It could have been mica, which only shines in the light. Then she thought, maybe it's morning dew.
So I just was like, okay, you know, I'm just going to paw at it with my hiking boot, and that'll disperse the dewdrops, and then we'll be done with the whole charade. And I do that, and it doesn't go anywhere.
That's because it was a 2.3-carat diamond, the third largest diamond found at Crater of Diamonds State Park this year.
It was like finishing a marathon. I just had this intense exhaustion and exuberance wash over me. And then I start laughing because it's done and I did it.
We asked her what kept her going for so many weeks.
if you take giving up off the table, the only thing left is to keep moving, to keep doing the hard thing. And that, you know, I feel like almost anything is possible if you take not being able to do it off the table.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Diamonds. What are your thoughts, Jen? You like them?
You know,
it's supposed to be like the hardest substance.
Diamonds are a girl's best friend, too.
I've heard that, too.
I guess I don't have a lot of opinions about diamonds. What about you? You big fan?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah?
I like them. They're pretty.
They're shiny.
Yeah.
I'm not a big gemstone person.
So one thing I've always wondered, like, I understand, like, diamonds are worth a lot because, like, they're a very hard substance and, like, can do stuff like that. But we mostly use them for show.
Right.
So why isn't, like, cubic zirconium, which looks like a diamond, why are we using that more? It's just for show anyway.
It's just
it looks
for
the
show.
Same.
See, people are weird, Andrew. I don't want to break this to you this early, but people are kind of strange. We just put value on things because, and then they have value because we say they do. But it's all kind of a house of cards.
I can't believe I pulled out cubic zirconium.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Thank you, Simpsons.
Do you know your birthstone, as long as we're talking gemstones?
September. It's a blue one, but I can't remember what it's actually called.
Do you want a hint, or are you never going to come up with it? Because we share a birthstone. We share a birth month.
Okay. Blue. Is it sapphire?
Yes, it is. Yay. Very good. Good job.
Is August... It's green.
Yeah, I think it starts with a P, but I don't know.
I'll never pull that.
Somebody can text us.
It's not emerald, is it?
No, that's May, I think.
Oh.
I think.
That's the only green gem I know.
Yeah. Like I said.
Is amethyst one of them?
Yes, that's February.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
I love amethyst.
Do you? Do you know there's more than just purple? Amethyst?
No, but I don't have no need for the other ones.
Purple.
I just want purple. Okay. It looks cool.
They are pretty.
It's like purple rock.
Yeah.
I wish we saw more purple rocks around.
Well, maybe you should put that on your birthday list that you'd like an amethyst.
No, I don't want one.
Oh.
I'm saying the earth, like our area should have more purple rocks.
I see. You're putting an order in.
So we're talking. This is the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeSingle here with the franchise Jen Kellen. And it is National Radio Day.
Yay.
Jen, do you remember what was your like childhood radio experience?
KBRK AM radio in Brookings, South Dakota.
Okay.
And it was just kind of always on in the background. They played a birthday song for me one time. I remember that.
Nice. What was the song?
Rubber Ducky. You're the one. Cute and cuddly. Lots of fun. I remember that. And then other core childhood radio memory is the Twins, Minnesota Twins baseball on the air.
Okay.
Listen to a lot of Twins baseball. I still do.
Yeah. We used to wake up to morning radio. XL93 was a big one, and then KJ108 when we got older.
Okay.
And
did you have, you're probably not this old, but did you have a radio alarm clock where you could set your alarm?
Yeah, we had a radio alarm clock.
Okay. Did you set your alarm and it turned on to the radio, not to
yep.
a, okay. Okay.
Yeah, those were cool.
Yeah. Do they still make
I
those?
I have one.
Still
I think,
currently?
I think. I don't know. I haven't really used it for an alarm clock in a while.
Yeah. That would be, I'm sure people do still.
So let us know your early radio experiences. Were you, did you wake up to the radio?
Maybe somebody woke up to us.
Yeah, did we wake you up?
We're sorry.
Text us at 218-326-1234. And Jen, did you ever think you'd be working in radio one day?
No.
During those early mornings?
Nope. Never. Never, wow. never. Still sometimes... Now I can't believe it. Did you have aspirations for being on the radio?
I thought I could do it. I didn't think it was going to happen. And now one of my dreams have come true.
Wow, you're living the dream.
So, what about like early music? Was it a music station? You didn't really talk about what kind of station it was.
So, growing up where I did, it was a little bit of a radio desert. There weren't a lot of choices for music. So I didn't listen to a ton of music on the radio growing up.
Really?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was like a talk radio station?
Well, yeah, the AM station from like when way a kid. But yeah, I mean, there was like a rock music station, which was on. There was an oldies music station. And then, of course, lots of commercial country music stations.
Mm-hmm. That was like primetime country.
Yeah, big time. Big time. So that's probably also like core teenage memories. Lots of commercial country. South Dakota Public Radio, though, every night had a show called Jazz Nightly, and it was hosted by Uncle Jimmo, which was so fun. And then, of course, South Dakota has two time zones. Eastern South Dakota is central.
I remember because when I went to South Dakota as a child, we were like, all right.